basically tap power back into your unit when you transmit. Use the online calculators, and I'm working VHF and UHF quite successfully. I'm going to trip. All of the online calculators tend to favor a design, measurements, and bend points that result in a 50-ohm match, and that's normally a very good thing. What I'm looking for is a little better vertical lobe compression or gain, and so wondering if there's like a 5/8 wave or a 3/8 wave design. Obviously the match wouldn't be 50 anymore, and we could deal with that other ways, obviously. But is there any information out there about higher gain or optimizing Moxons beyond the basic 50 ohm design? D3ZTZ back to net.
Okay, I should have some knowledge about a Moxon antenna, and I don't. But I'm going to speak in general, and maybe it'll still help us, Scott. When you and I take something like a quarter wave ground plane antenna mounted right on the dirt of your backyard, for instance, and we talk about the vertical angle of radiation, yes, in theory, you get a lot of power out to the horizon on a vertical antenna if and only if your ground has infinite conductivity. You're doing it above salt water. The latest issue of QST Magazine, the December issue, in the Doctor is In section, addresses this, and he shows you diagrams of what happens with perfect ground and with imperfect ground of a quarter wave ground plane. What's really happening is that in the case of a quarter wave ground plane, there is a real quarter wave length radiator above the ground. The mirror image of one below the ground, because of the reflection off the ground, gives you the other half of the dipole. It's really a dipole-like antenna, electronically speaking. And so how much in phase and out of phase is the above radiator and the below radiator when you start getting real ground resistivity, which has also got a capacitive effect to it, which is giving you a phase delay. So you start ending up with an elevation angle out of that antenna. And if you go to a horizontal dipole, because any signal reflecting from a horizontal dipole off the ground experiences 180-degree phase reversal on the ground reflection. That tends to give you a perfect null on the horizon, and some number of degrees above the horizon is where the ground reflection signal and the direct signal come back in phase with each other. So your vertical angle of radiation on a horizontal dipole is 95% determined by the number of wavelengths the antenna is above the ground. Now here you are, a vertical cave dweller, some number, a significant number of floors above Mother Earth. And now you've got a very different environment. There's so many wavelengths above the ground that now your ground reflection takes on a very different characteristic. The reflection off of steel and other objects in your building is what's now going to determine a good portion of your vertical elevation angle. And whether you use a quarter wave, half wave, 5/8 wave, or whatever radiators makes a little bit of difference in the gain, a dB or two. Whereas the vertical angle of radiation, if your particular horizontal dipole, for instance, let me drop. If your horizontal dipole is some number of wavelengths above the ground so that your vertical angle of radiation peaks at, let me pick a number, 45 degrees up, and down at the horizon, your lobe might be, let me pick a number, 30 decibels weaker. And that's where the long-range DX you want to operate is, low to the ground. So there you can get a gut feel for the fact that raising the dipole can easily make that minus 30 dB down lobe on the horizon go minus 20 and minus 15 and so on, and the vertical angle starts coming down. So number of wavelengths above the reflecting ground plane is a big factor. You've already got that altitude. Now all you have to worry about is the pattern of the antenna and the way you're getting reflection off the building. If you had a thoroughly symmetric vertical or horizontal dipole, and if there was the same number of steel girders on the floors above you and the floors below you in your building, so you're somewhere in the middle of that building, you've got the great advantage, as I see it, Scott, where a hell of a lot of your power is automatically aimed at the horizon, whether you're horizontally or vertically polarized. So your vertical angle of radiation, if you've got reasonable altitude, is really not a function of ground anymore. It's a function of electronically what does the rest of your building look like. That's a bunch of opinions on what little data I've got on this one, Scott. DE3ZTZ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
That's a very interesting comment, given my anecdotal experience when I switched from an Omni to the first Maxon that I homebrewed. It punched with so much better performance than the Omni. I almost fell down at the range I was getting out of it. So I might have, to sum it up differently, I might have just fluked because I am center, well, just below center of the building height. I may have just fluked on the perfect formula. So your suggestion is not to tinker with the 50 ohm match and the basic quarter wave design, because you're not going to crank more than a dB or so out of the vertical loop. All right, I can live with that. My second question on the Maxon, if I may. My first ones are built with copper plumber's tube, so they're cylindrical. I have the ability, I have a stash of aluminum rod bars, about a quarter or 3/8 inch thick, and I've got some that are 1.5 and some that are 2 inches wide. I know that something with a circumference presents a so-called infinite plane to the RF signal. I was wondering what using a bar as a radiator would do to that, pro or con.
There are guys, Scott, who have made a stealth antenna, which they try to make physically invisible because their landlord won't let them put up an antenna. And they made the antenna out of 30-gauge wire. And they made a dipole-like structure out of 30-gauge wire using buttons as the insulators and black string beyond that, so to speak. And they got 90% of the performance of a full dipole that's made out of 14-gauge household wire. And as you start making the 14-gauge household wire thicker and thicker, you go to 6-gauge household wire, and you start making a birdcage out of it. Until you get a significant portion of a wavelength in the diameter of the radiator, not much happens to bandwidth, gain, pattern, whatever. You can get a feel for this impedance-wise, but let me backtrack now. You're worried about pattern. The pattern changes very slowly as a diameter. When you go to aluminum versus copper, and we start thinking about the skin effect, the only thing I really worry about now is that can I make good outdoor permanent contact to that aluminum? Aluminum soldering sounds good, but quite often outdoors it doesn't have good survival to it. Maybe with the right kind of no locks and some other kind of dissimilar metal salve that you put between the contacting ground lug, so to speak, and the aluminum rod, you can make good contact, and you can coat it with some elastic adhesive or wrap it with black tape. Let me drop it. So making good contact to the antenna, no matter what materials you use, is the main thing I worry about when you go over to aluminum. And the actual diameter, whether it be flat, round, or whatever, because of skin effect, you worry about what is the real resistivity of the material. That 30-gauge wire operating on, let me pick a number, 20 meters or on 40 meters, probably has a wider resistance at the RF frequency of, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 ohms. And on a 70-ohm impedance antenna, you can calculate what percentage of your power is going into the resistive loss of the wire versus being radiated into space. And in that example I just gave, you still have a substantial proportion of the power going into space. And you start going from 14-gauge wire down to 0-gauge wire, the change in resistivity is now a law of diminishing returns on a 70-ohm antenna. In your particular environment where you're in the middle of the building, I think you're going to get the greatest amount of performance out of a symmetric antenna, dipole-like structure, where the upper half and the lower half have the exact same length, and there's the right kind of a balancing device between the two halves going to the coax cable. Because if you don't have a balancing device on a symmetric dipole, Mother Nature wants symmetry. Let me drop. If you're about to put 100 volts of RF across the center of a dipole, and you're just worried about the peak voltage of 100 volts between the right-hand side and the left-hand side, on the positive and the negative half cycles, the voltage reverses, but you know what I mean. You think you're going to put 100 volts across it, and everything's hunky-dory. Mother Nature looks at that full symmetric dipole, and she says, I want plus 50 volts on the right side and minus 50 volts on the left side during the first half cycle. During the second half cycle, it's going to be reversed. That's what she wants when you feed the center of a dipole. If you take just an ordinary piece of coax cable and you connect the shield to the left-hand side of the dipole and the semiconductor to the right side, and because Mother Nature wants that dipole to be symmetric with reference to the rest of the universe, she's trying very hard with the 100 volts that you're launching with your coax. She's forcing 50 volts on the left-hand side that's connected to your coax shield. Therefore, in the worst case, 50 volts of RF goes crawling back down the outside of your coax cable. And now what you think is transmission line is part of the antenna, and that RF energy goes crawling back into the shack. You put the right kind of a balancing device right at the dipole, which acts as an RF choke, and even the poor man's equivalent, a few turns of the coax cable held together with black tape, acting as an RF choke right at the dipole, a poor man's dipole, a poor man's balance, is a good way to go. You gotta stop the RF energy from flowing back down. So, with the right kind of, with the right kind of balancing device, you're really symmetrically feeding a real symmetric half-wave dipole-like structure. And whether you make each half side 5/8 wave instead of quarter wave, whatever, those are minor details. But a thoroughly symmetric dipole, properly fed, in the middle of the building. Under those conditions, you'd have to work real hard to stop your elevation angle on the horizon from not being the major probe, the major angle of your radiation. And your DX is going to start pouring in like you wouldn't believe. That's a bunch of opinions, and I think you're in the driver's seat here, Scott. VE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Again, thank you very much. What you're saying matches my sort of anecdotal experience with my first two homebrews. So thank you very much. Appreciate the answer. Appreciate, again, the discipline with the air gaps. It's really helping us up here on the reflector. And let's move on with someone else. Thanks again. VE3ZTZ, back to them.
And Scott, as you do these further examples of with your antennas, and I'm going to look up Moxon because I should know about it, but I don't, please come back and tell us what you did, whether it works or doesn't work. Please come back and tell us what you did. Let me make a guess. Are you five floors above the ground on a 10-story building? Are you somewhere like that in the middle of the building? Back to you for a quickie, Scott.
Yeah, affirmative. We're five on a 14, so we're just below half, more than a third, less than a half.
Fantastic. You got it made. And so, usually, a guy who thinks he's got the ideal antenna farm is sitting on 5 acres of property. It's on top of a hill. But the right kind of antenna used from a good, tall apartment building can do an awful good job. Let us know in the future how that all works out. Tim, Kilo Delta 2, Baker Uniform Mike, or is it Baker Victor Mike? I'm having trouble reading my my handwriting here, Tim. Go right ahead with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick, it's Tim. It's Bravo Victor Mike V. I have a very simple question, and it stems up the same. We had a generator, and I had a portable power pole back, and I was hesitant to recharge my handheld Roxxon radio on those. I felt the lithium ion battery wasn't going to be strong enough to take current from that. A handheld be charged from directed on the generator or through an inverter?
A household generator that makes 120 volts AC or 240 volts AC, those kind of portable motor generator sets that a lot of people were using during this event. Yes, if you look at that voltage on a high-resolution oscilloscope, you'll see a couple of little funny squiggets, a couple of little bumps on the beautiful sine wave. And when it comes to certain kinds of radio equipment, operating off of that, sometimes the electromagnetic interference of those tiny little bumps on the waveform will give you some extra static in the radio when it's receiving. But for the most part, motor generator sets put out a kind of voltage that's pretty safe. It's a little bit less regulated. In other words, when you're running on Con Ed power or LiPa power, you've got 60.000 hertz per second. That's the frequency. And when you're running on a motor generator set, your motor generator set probably sometimes is down to 58 hertz, and sometimes it's up to 62 hertz. That's a very minor difference. And the voltage is a little bit less regulated. On a good day, when you're running on Con Ed and LiPa power, you're probably 118 volts plus or minus 2 volts. And when you're running on the generator, depending on whether or not the refrigerator has just turned on and the oil burner has just turned on, for a short period of time, the voltage out of the generator is going to go down to 109, and for a short period of time, it's going to go up to 130. These are very minor differences. When you're using a wall-wart-like charger into the battery of your handy-talkie, these are very minor disturbances. So your fear of some kind of damage, let me drop this. Your fear of some kind of damage happening to your handy-talkie because you're running on generator power while you're charging it, I think you don't have to worry, Tim. I think that's not a problem. A well-designed handy-talkie, you would be amazed how rugged they are. On an ordinary transmitter like your desktop ham radio transmitter, you make the mistake of not connecting the antenna, but you didn't know it. In other words, the back of the radio is operating into an open circuit, and you press down the key or you squeeze the mic and you start transmitting. There's a 10 or 20% chance you've just blown the final stage of that transmitter. You could do some really bad damage by something that bad in this match. You take almost any handy-talkie you and I can get a hold of, and you unplug the rubber duck, and you transmit at full power. The radio will sit there and laugh at you and keep right on running. I don't think 1% of the time you can destroy a handy-talkie by having it fire into a dead short circuit or a dead open circuit. They are very rugged along those lines. When it comes to the voltage you supply to them, my ICOM IC2AT, an old, old rig, it's supposed to get something in the vicinity of 8 volts to run correctly. All the way down to 6 volts, it keeps working. All the way up to 13 volts, it keeps working. In other words, you can have 50% error in either direction on the voltage, and the thing keeps right on cranking. So, as you see, handy-talkies, my particular handy-talkie, has been dropped from the 100-foot level of a tower onto the lawn. It was dropped from the 70-foot level of a tower down to blacktop macadam in a parking lot, because I was climbing a tower one day and it fell off my belt when I dropped. I had this sinking feeling watching the radio go down 70 feet and smash into the ground. And the battery is a heavy part. That goes down first. The thing aims itself like an arrow and the battery gets smashed. I replaced the battery and the radio was still cranking and I'm still using it to this day. As you can tell, you've got to really do something pretty darn bad. If you put reverse polarity into the radio, I think you could damage it. But short of that, boy, are they rugged. Maybe that helps, Kim. Stop worrying. KD2, Baker, Victor, Mike. T2RIW in the TechNet.
Contact, real quick, VE3JIW.
VE3JIW, that's Jim. And I'll pick you up in a minute, Jim. Let me hear from Kim first. And maybe you've got some comments along these lines. Kim, go right ahead with whether or not that... Was I on the right subject, Kim? Over to you, Kim.
Very well. I wasn't doing much talking, so I got 3 days out of batteries
because
I was just listening. But thank you very much for the information. I appreciate it.
Yeah, what I strongly recommend you do, Kim, what I did, overly coincidental, I went and bought a pair of more NiCad batteries. NiCad or were they nickel metal hydride? I bought a pair of batteries for my handy talkie and charged up all of them before the event occurred. So having enough charged batteries around is a nice way to go. You take the average person with a cell phone and you ask them, how many spare batteries do you own for your cell phone? And they'll look at you strangely and say, what's that? And in many of the cell phones nowadays, the battery is glued in. You can't even change it. you can charge your cell phone from a cigarette lighter of an automobile. You've got an infinite amount of power in that battery in that automobile. You could charge 150 cell phones easily, and the majority of the world didn't have that device. What a waste. Jim, how would you guys go up there with extra battery power? VE3JIW, KTRLIW. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, I'm packing the lead in my cottage. We travel by boat about a mile. It's right on freezing. Something you failed to catch, generators. I was running on a generator in the summer, and everything's great. We got TV, radio, water pump. My telephone shuts down. Wallward, dead. My security system is a 20-watt, 110-to-60-volt transformer. The output is disconnected, so that there's no load in the transformer. It goes dead. It's sinking hot. I didn't have a way to check frequency, but I noticed all my wound transformers, square iron pieces, winding transformers, were sinking hot. I determined from what I know that I had low generator speed. I had phenomenal fuel economy, but I had to bump the speed control up a bit because I had low frequency. My thinking is, if you have a generator, you put an old-style cable clock, the plug it in and hear it humming because it runs on 60 cycles, run it for an hour and see if it keep an hour. Would that be a way to check a generator's frequency? Run it for an hour and check if an hour has passed. You don't have a frequency counter. Just what happened was, I'm going to trip it. Failed in the wall wart. I lost the winding in the telephone one, and a thermal protection device opened inside the transformer for the alarm system. So it was zero load on the transformer, and it cooked. The thermal cutout cooked. And the telephone, wireless telephone wall wart was cooked due to heat. So I'm thinking standard old style clock, 60 cycles. If you're running a 50 cycle, the clock would run 50 minutes instead of an hour in 1 hour of running.
That's a very good suggestion, Jim, to use a clock as a coarse frequency indicator. That's a very good suggestion. And yes, if the manufacturer of the transformer that's in your wall wart or any other kind of a power supply, if he did a marginal design, if he barely put enough iron in there and enough quality of the iron that it just barely works at 60 hertz, you can easily run into the problem where at 55 hertz, the transformer is starting to saturate on each half cycle and therefore generating a hell of a lot of heat. I ran into that problem with the spectrum analyzer that Airborne Instruments Laboratory was building way back in the middle 70s, where we bought a power supply that had a transformer in it that was rated for 50 and 60 hertz. And everything we did in the United States was 60 hertz. We started shipping some of those spectrum analyzers to a section of Japan that ran on 50 hertz. And those transformers were making very loud humming sounds, putting out very strong magnetic fields that made the signal on the screen dance and do all kinds of crazy things. And we finally did an investigation, and we found out that the manufacturer of the power supply, a vendor in New Jersey, let me drop. He had bought a brand new lot of the EI laminations that he makes the transformer core out of, and he bought slightly cheaper iron that had a little bit lower mu to it, but he didn't recheck the design accordingly. And so the transformer was extremely marginal below, let me pick a number, 55 hertz. And in Japan, it had to run on 50 hertz. So if the transformer is marginal in design and you go a little bit lower in frequency, you will get a hell of a lot more primary winding saturation. And now when that winding does saturate, the back EMF that's normally created by the magnetic field, and because the mu of the material is lower and therefore the iron saturates, therefore the winding doesn't develop the right amount of back EMF, and therefore you get a hell of a lot of standby current in that primary winding. So you're getting IR loss with the extra current in the primary winding. You're getting a hell of a lot of extra heat in the core itself because the magnetic material is saturating. And the bottom line, everything runs pretty hot. So for a generator, under normal circumstances, as I see it, Jim, a generator really goes more than a couple of hertz high or low. For your particular generator to be that low, I'm going to guess that when you do the test, you're going to find out it was running at the 54 hertz, we're going to say. and then maybe there's some kind of a voltage regulator in there that compensated for the fact that the RPM was lower, and normally it would generate a lower voltage. So maybe the voltage was right. And by the way, if the generator was running in the thoroughly linear mode, lower RPM would be both lower hertz and lower voltage coming out, and they should almost balance as far as saturating transformers are concerned. So you, as a scientist, Jim, are probably going to do a little
question.
You, as a scientist, are probably going to do a little bit more investigation as to why your transformers ran that hot. Let me go back to Jim first. VE3JIW, KQRIW in the TechNet.
WV2U with a comment.
13 to Cord, even had a 108 volts from a cousin running fridge. We didn't cook the fridge, kind of started on 300 feet of cord, but our voltage was good. I was like 112, 113, not 120. Never got a frequency meter on it. Bumped the idle up by ear. Didn't run a lot of transformer stuff. I actually did it the weird way. I had a 20 or 30 amp, 24 volt supply, and I checked the temperature of that transformer, and it bumped the RPM a little, the screwdriver, and later on checked the transformer. It was too hot, so I carried on waiting for the hydro to recover.
So if I understand correctly, Jim, you haven't yet done the clock test yet to find out how low was the generator running. I guess by way of your tuned ear, you can go back to that generator setting, find out how slow your clock ran, and as I said before, a transformer that doesn't have a marginal design shouldn't behave that way unless your generator really was way out in the blue, like running at 48 hertz instead of 60. We got both Wes and Paul in that order when I ask a further question. What's your question on this one, Wes? N2XJN, K2LIW?
Is permeability of 4,000 or 3,000 sufficient enough for that task? And say we use ferrite.
If you've got enough area of the core, in other words, the winding of the primary and the secondary have enough airspace in the middle, whether or not you're using mu of 1,000, 3,000, or 10,000 is compensatable. If you use a lower mu material and there's enough of it, the transformer will not saturate. Or conversely, if you've got very high mu capable material, very high saturation mu material, and you've got less of it, you can still have a good design. So the design is not a function of the exact mu. It's a combination of area and mu and a bunch of other things. Transformer design, there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Paul, WV2U, go right ahead with your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Saturating coefficients be affected if I have too much of airspace in it.
Okay, very good, Dick. In my professional experience, I experimented a lot with early UPSs trying to support a device off a wall wart transformer. And my big problem was that the step waveform would destroy the wall warts pretty quickly. I had to go to a pure sine wave UPS. So I'm wondering if that generator...
You stopped very abruptly, Paul, but you're wondering if that generator was putting out anything but a pure sine wave. Most rotary inverter-like motor generator sets do put out what primarily is a sine wave. Yes, many of our inexpensive brand of UPSs put out a stepped square wave, and the stepped square wave does have a lot of higher harmonic frequency energy in it. So for certain kinds of transformers where the EI laminations are not thin enough, the higher frequency components can give you a lot of extra heating of the core, and also the way the primary backing EMF behaves. And so the core itself, if you've got what you think is a good design of a transformer, and then you go out and buy brand X of EI laminations, which have lower saturation flux and lower mu, and if you combine that with poor assembly procedure, where you've got a lot more air gap in the EI laminations the way they're married, by a whole lot of procedures, you can end up with a reluctance of the magnetic path that is a hell of a lot lower than it should be, and one that saturates a hell of a lot sooner. And therefore, the 120 volts on that many turns of the primary winding is going to create saturation. Had the manufacturer used a few more turns on the primary winding for that particular design of the core, he would have gotten away with it. But now he's got to spend a little bit more money on the copper. So it's a combination of prices and all kinds of things going on here. As you can see, good transformer design with enough margin in the design, that's an art and science to itself. But there's another item going on here. Let me drop. That is, I heard a hell of a lot of complaints, and I'm one of them, of people who are running on generator power into a UPS, into their computer, or other things in the device, but mostly in the computer. I and a bunch of my friends had the problem that when we're running on a generator, a beautiful motor generator set, where, as I said before, when you look at it with an oscilloscope, it's a reasonably good-looking sine wave. But something about that sine wave, whether it's the minor little bumps in it or the exact frequency, made the UPS unhappy. And the UPS kept flipping back and forth every 2 seconds between the active and the inactive mode. One of my buddies, it spent so much time, such a high duty factor in the active mode that it eventually killed the battery in the UPS, even though we had continuous generator power going into it. In my particular case, the UPS kept flipping back and forth, making a glitch every time it flipped, and eventually one of those glitches bombed my computer. And so, even though I had what I thought was beautiful telephone and beautiful internet connection, my computer, firewall system, which is a separate computer in the house, went into a glitch mode because all the spiking that was being created by the UPS was switching back and forth every couple of seconds. We found out from, I guess it was Scott last week, that in some cases, let me drop. In the case of APC brand name of UPSs, among other brand names, you can download some software where you can talk to the microprocessor inside of your UPS, and you can expand its acceptance window. I don't know the exact numbers, but maybe a UPS that's made to work on 118 volts, when it sees more than 122 or less than 113, it goes from the inactive mode to the active mode. It thinks that the beginning of a brownout or a whiteout is about. It thinks that a failure is about to happen, and it goes to the active mode. So I think you can expand that window, but as they come from the factory, they are very persnickety, and that persnicketiness can give you a lot of grief. Anybody with any questions or comments on this one, give me a call. It is K2LAW on the TechNet.
And yeah, what about the coupling coefficient?
Coupling, okay. As you start making the magnetic structure of a transformer more and more marginal, by that I mean you're using iron that saturates sooner, iron that has a lower mu, bigger air gaps. As you start making all of these errors in the magnetic structure of a transformer, two or three things start happening. You start getting saturation of the primary winding. What you think is a beautiful sine wave that you're applying becomes a current waveform that's anything but sinusoidal. And the coupling between primary and secondary starts changing. And the voltage you get out of the secondary starts going down, and you're developing a crazy waveform. There's a zillion ways you can destroy the beautiful operation of a transformer. There was another person that was copying, that was trying to break in there. Who was that? K2LAW? I checked before that last transmission, there was another person who wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Okay. Let's go to the mailbag, John. KC2WGB. What kind of letters have we gotten this week? You got it, John. KQIIW.
Dick, one comment on the UPS, the battery problem, WS2N.
Go right ahead, Paul.
One of those things. I was thinking about getting it. Now I'm starting to wonder if it's worth it. Is there a bypass? Or maybe would be better off just unplugging the whole setup when you're on generator and just plug, just forget about the backup battery. How would you consider run on that?
What I did do is to unplug the normal protected output of my APC brand UPS and took the computer and the display device and plugged them into the other two ports, the so-called surge protected ports, but they're not part of the UPS, and I turned the UPS off to stop all of that clicking going on. So I did manage to get back to what looked like normal computer operation and display operation. That's the good news. The bad news is that my separate computer in the basement, which is part of the firewall system, had already been damaged by a glitch. The memory card in it developed a glitch, and it therefore no longer was a usable firewall system. So I was, by all practical purposes, disconnected, and I had no internet for a number of days during the event. I was on generator power for 4 days. Okay, so let's go over to Paul. I mean, here we go, John. KC2WGB. What kind of mail have we gotten this week, John? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Alrighty, have you skipped over me on the list?
We called for you a few times and you didn't respond. Joe, are you back? Go ahead.
Maybe I was awake in the radio or out of earshot momentarily and I meant to see the cycling. Yeah, I'm back on here.
Go right ahead with your question, Joe. And wait 1 or 2 seconds beyond the 4 beeps.
Okay, I'm coming into the echo link, so I don't know if that applies to me spatially. My question is actually pretty, very simple. In many cases, a lot of us try to repair different things, and it's hard to sometimes create the same type of apparatus used on testing particular radios to put them under certain test conditions to adjust them properly. For example, adjusting the transmitter of some of these HF ham transceivers requires an impedance of 25 ohms. Well, that might be pretty easy to make by putting 250 ohm loads in parallel, and you get 25 ohms or, you know, reasonably decent accuracy. How would you achieve something like that? Because I know in the one transceiver I have, it requires a 150 ohm impedance for proper adjustment of some of the power shutdown circuitry inside the radio. Back to you.
Most signal generators with reasonable setting of the output attenuator are very tolerant. In other words, when you got the signal generator cranked up to full blast power, yes, it wants to see 50 ohms. But if you got it down to, let me pick a number, minus 50 dBm coming out of the signal generator that's capable of plus 5 dBm, you added that, let's set it minus 50. If you terminate the output of that signal generator with 150 ohms instead of 50 ohms, you're going to get a slightly different voltage output, and the amount of voltage output you're going to get is mathematically very predictable. And the generator will be happy, and it keeps right on cranking. I'm not talking about a generator that does not have an automatic leveling loop. If you're using an automatic leveling loop, I'll admit that life gets a little bit more complicated. But even that is predictable. So, the generator itself, an ordinary signal generator, if you put in series with the semiconductor a 100-ohm resistor, so that now you've got 50 ohms from the signal generator, another 100-ohm resistor, and now the radio that you're testing will look back into that network, and it will see 150 ohms. The radio is now happy. The slight difference in the voltage or power coming out of the signal generator is predictable, and now I think that simple solution I just described is one of the ways of doing it. And that would be an extremely broadband solution. Yes, you want to make that 100-ohm resistor, in my example, a very small surface mount resistor so that the series inductance of it does not complicate the situation. But with a good microscope and a good layout of the kind of parts you can come up with, I think you could make that circuit work very nicely up to at least 1,000 megacycles, Joe. So the A2LYY, K2LIW, that's one of many solutions, by the way. You got it, Joe.
I think you missed my question as I was asking to you. Maybe I should have specified. This is the adjusting the transmitter portion of the radio. So you have to be able to transmit in to this device. That's what I was getting at.
Okay, the word "this device" is not very descriptive. Are you telling me you've got a 100-watt transmitter that for whatever reason must be terminated with 150 ohms? Is that what you're saying, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes. That is correct.
Okay. And are you doing this test only at one particular frequency, or do you have to do it at a whole lot of frequencies? Over to you, Joe.
I believe the test is only done on one specific frequency on one particular band. You're basically trying to adjust the tollback circuitry in the transmitter so when it theoretically sees a certain impedance, in this case 100 feet over impedance, it will do a certain predictive thing to the transmitter and the radio when adjusted properly. That was the purpose of me asking the question. How would you easily make a 100 feet over impedance that's going to, you know, look reasonably good to the radio to satisfy it?
Okay, as long as you've only got to do it at one frequency, a quarter wave coaxial transformer will do a beautiful job. So you take a piece of coaxial cable, a quarter wavelength long, of just the right impedance. It will present 50 ohms on the left-hand side and 150 ohms on the right-hand side if the quarter wavelength length of line is 86.6 ohms. You take the input impedance, the output impedance, multiply them together, take the square root, and that's the impedance of the quarter wavelength line. The next question is going to be, how do I make a piece of line 86.6 ohms? And that is, you take a piece of round tubing that's going to be the outer conductor. You go to the right equation that tells you what the semiconductor diameter should be to make 86.6 ohms. You go to your nearest hobby shop and you buy some K&S brass tubing of that diameter and you build the thing. So a quarter wave matching transformer is another one of the solutions. And I guarantee there's at least 10 more. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
So this apparatus apparently is very easy to build if you're going to make this thing work at, say, a test frequency of 30 megahertz.
I will admit that a quarter wavelength line at 30 megahertz does represent a bit of a problem. 86.6 ohms, let's see, a quarter wavelength is going to be, 16 feet is a half wave, if I remember correctly. Yeah, 16 feet, I think, is a half wave at 10 meters, 30 megacycles. So a quarter wave would be 8 feet. 8 feet of this, yeah, that's out of the question. You're not going to use brass tubing out of the hobby shop for 8 feet. The next way to do it would be, there is 90-ohm coax cable. 90-ohm coax cable is very close to 86.6. It's going to give you a little bit of error. And if you want it to come out perfect, you put the right kind of a shunt resistor on one end and you will make it act like 86.6 ohms. So you'll have a little bit of the power wasted in a predictable manner by putting a shunt resistor on one of the ends. Use 90-ohm coax, a quarter wavelength of it, including the velocity factor, and it will give you the impedance match between 50 ohms out of the transmitter and 150 ohms for the load, or vice versa. It's a reversible device. You see what I'm getting at here, Rocho? That's one way of doing it. Depending on the power level you're running and the frequency you're running, it can also be done with toroidal transformers. Life's a little bit more complicated that way. I mean, to choose the right amount of ferrite, the right amount of cross-sectional area, the right number of turns, you're going to get into a whole lot of other research items to try to do it with transformers. If it's going to be part of a production line, most likely you would do it, you'd go through all of the, let me drop it. If it's part of a production line, most likely you'd go through all of those equations and do it with the right kind of a toroidal transformer-like device. But for a 1Z2Z here that you need, I think using a piece of 90-ohm coax cable, which is a purchasable item, that's one possible solution. I will admit that 90-ohm coax cable doesn't come into high power. You're not going to run a kilowatt of this thing with 90-ohm cable. And maybe you could do it if you do it very briefly and put the cable in a bath of ice water. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet. Hams can find all kinds of crafty ways of getting around these problems, Joe.
Okay, I wasn't trying to think of a way of doing it with coax cable. I thought maybe something using some sort of, you know, resistive network, but that was made fairly accurate, so it would be sort of flat across the entire band in case you had to use it on different frequencies, because initially I think they described using something like that, but I'm not sure how they construct this thing.
Okay, if you now go to a website, I think Berkeley berkeley.com or berkeley.org is a website by Berkeley University, California, and you tell it what impedance you have at one end of your black box, what impedance you have at the other end, resistive component and reactive component, and what frequency you're operating at, and you press go, and that program will give you 16 solutions as 16 separate diagrams with the capacitor value and the inductor value required to do it as a LC network. So the next step up is to do it as a L network. Out of the transmitter, a series inductor and a shunt capacitor of just the right number of microhenries and picofarads will have as an input 50 ohms and an output of 150 ohms with no reactance at your frequency. And while you're at it, that network would even correct for extra capacitive or inductive reactance on either end. So an L network is the next step of a solution. And whether the L network be L on top and series and capacitor and shunt, or capacitor series and inductor shunt, there's two separate solutions there. Then when you start going into pi networks, pi L networks, all 16 of those solutions will appear automatically when you find that website and you give it that raw data, and 3 minutes later you've got 16 solutions and you can choose the one that you like the most. So the H-U-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W in the TechNet.
And that website again is berkeley.org?
I haven't gone to it for 6 months, but the last time, that was my memory. And Berkeley, by the way, is spelled in the funny way that they do in Berkeley, California. B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y or something like that. It's got some extra letters or lacking letters, but it's a website done by Berkeley University in California. By way of Google and whatever, you will find it. And it's a beautiful impedance. You Google the words Berkeley impedance matching, and Google will tell you exactly how to find that website. And you go there, and you're going to say, wow, why hasn't somebody told me this sooner? So the H-U-L-Y-Y, K-U-L-I-W.
Great. That sounds like it's better than a K-U-L-I-W solution. Thank you very much, Dick.
Enjoy, Joe. And when you do find that website, when you do actually look at that solution, all 16 of them, and you choose one of them, come back and let us know how well it's working for your particular situation. John, you better grab it before we get lost again. KC2WGB, tell me what's in your mailbag, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm trying to leave enough delay there, Dick. It was tough. Okay. Good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. All right. My first question comes from an amateur who went to a fair and bought a noise generator, but he has no idea what to do with it. What is it used for? It's an HP, no model number, but he'd like to know the applications. Back to you, Dick.
There's lots and lots of different kinds of noise generators, some of them for audio, some of them for RF. Let's assume that it's an RF noise generator.
It is RF.
Okay, it's RF. Let me drop. And let's assume that stamped on the side, it says useful from 10 megacycles to 1 gigahertz, or useful from 100 megacycles to 3 gigahertz. And if it has a known noise output, like 15.5 decibels of T excess, usually the label on the side will tell you something like that. If that's the kind of noise generator, which is a very popular kind, it is intended to be the source of, quote, signal, unquote, for an automatic noise figure indicator. When you're testing the quality of the front-end RF amplifier, of a high-quality VHF, usually receiver, the thing that you and I care about is what is its noise figure. Unfortunately, many of the rice boxes that we buy, like, for instance, my Kenwood 711A in the single sideband mode on 2 meters. It's a 2 meter all mode rig. I believe in the sideband mode, the barefoot rig runs something like 12 decibels of noise figure. And you're going to say, why does such a beautiful design of a rig do that? And the answer is, it was designed for downtown Tokyo. In Tokyo, you've got a ham radio operator on every single street corner. So front-end overload is a hell of a lot more important to them than ultimate sensitivity. Therefore, gain-wise, those rigs are starved. You put a whole lot of gain in the front-end with a very low noise figure preamplifier. The good news is you'll be able to listen to very weak signals. The bad news is that a guy half a mile away can overload your front-end and make intermods all over in that receiver. So they emphasize the design for strong signals. As such, you and I can get around the problem by buying something like a... You buy something like a Advanced Receiver Research preamplifier, the one that has the bypass relays in it. The good news is that it can give you a fraction of 1 decibel of noise figure on 2 meters or 432, for instance. That's the good news. And it's got a little switch on the side where you can turn it on and off. You can go to the bypass mode when you're transmitting, or when you decide that there's a strong signal present, you don't turn on the preamp. Or if you're listening to a weak signal, you turn on the preamp. It's got 20 decibels of gain and 1 decibel of noise figure. It'll take your 12 decibel noise figure receiver and bring the whole combination down to under 1 decibel of noise figure. You'll get approximately 11 or 12 decibels of more sensitivity when you do that. Now, how do you test the quality of that preamplifier? By turning on and off that noise generator at a 400 cycle square wave waveform, which is being issued by an automatic noise figure indicator. The automatic noise figure indicator knows that that noise source is in front of the preamplifier. The output of the preamplifier goes into the rest of the circuitry of the automatic noise figure indicator. It does a fancy mathematical calculation of synchronous demodulation. In other words, it measures a certain amount of average noise power when the noise source is on. It measures a slightly lower amount of noise power coming out of the preamplifier when the noise source at the input is turned off. The ratio of those two is called the Y factor. The circuitry inside of the automatic noise figure indicator looks at that Y factor, does a calculation, and displays on its needle on the front panel of the last valve movement or the digital output. It says that this combination is now displaying 0.95 decibels of noise.
Repeater, timeout.
In my example, it'll say digitally or by the meter that the combination of that system that you're now testing has a overall noise figure of 0.95 decibels. And so that's a very quantitative thing. A properly designed noise source. That's one of the major ways it's used. In theory, the exact amount of noise power coming out of it, when they say it's got 15.5 decibels of TXS, a very typical number for noise sources. You could say, simplistically, it is 15 decibels louder than a 50-ohm resistor at room temperature, 290 degrees Kelvin. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit, because the actual way the equations work are a little bit more complicated than that. But you have a known amount of excess noise louder than the environment, and if your preamplifier was perfect, 0 dB noise figure, because the noise on and noise off of your noise source. When your noise source is turned off, you're looking into a 50-ohm pad that's on the output of the noise source. You see 290 degrees Kelvin noise-wise. When it's turned on, you're seeing some number of thousands of degrees Kelvin of noise. If your preamplifier was perfect, the 15 decibels of on-off ratio of noise going in would be 15 decibels of on-off ratio coming out of the preamplifier. The automatic noise figure indicator would look at that and say, aha, that's a 0 dB noise figure preamp. As your preamplifier gets noisier and noisier, the noise of your preamp starts overriding the noise coming out of the noise source. And if you were testing, let me pick a number, a preamplifier, let me drop. If you're testing a really bad preamplifier that you've blown the front end on it, and it's got a 35 decibel noise figure, and you're turning on and off this noise source that's got a 15.5 dB ratio of on-off going into this yucky green amplifier, what will come out will not be a 15 dB ratio of on-off. It'll be half a dB of ratio of on-off, because the continuous noise of the 35 dB of noise figure of this yucky preamplifier is dominating. So the lower Y factor will be calculated as a higher noise figure, and it will tell you, hey dummy, you've got a 35 dB noise figure preamplifier there. You've probably blown that transistor, that MGF-1402. It's time you unsolder it and put a new one in there, because you've blown it with a lightning strike or reverse polarity of voltage. You've done something bad to it. KC2WGV, K2LIW in the Fed Nest.
KC2WGV. All right, Dick, let me make sure I get the beep. Okay, very good. I don't believe I own one of those devices. I've never used it, so good description. I suggest he gets online and gets the manual for it, because he indicated he didn't have a manual for it. And that would probably give him some direction of where he could go and learn a few things about it. All right, let me go to the next question. Let me let it drop.
KC2BHY, just a quick comment.
Okay, Jim. I don't know where it is, but there is a magic website where you can download almost any one of the manuals for the Hewlett-Packard test equipment line. Wait for the beep, 1 or 2 seconds beyond the four beeps, Jim, and go ahead with your question on this subject, or any other subject you'd like to ask about, Jim. KD2BHY, K2LIW in the second end.
Did anything up here about I was just wondering if you got my email, the schematic I was talking about last second.
I think I did not get your email, Jim. First of all, what day did you mail the email? I was looking immediately after you and I had that discussion, and I didn't see it. So maybe a few days downrange is when you sent it. Back to you, Jim.
Yesterday, but I sent it from my iPod, so I'm not sure it went through or not, because I've never done that before.
Is it your usual email address, or would it be a very different email address? And what was the title you put on it? So I have to go and look for it, Jim. And unfortunately, I'm not going to get a chance to do that tonight. So what title did you put on it, and is it your normal email address? Back to you, Jim.
The email address is KD2BHY, my call sign, and then QRP@gmail.com. And the title was, I think I might have sent it twice by accident, but the title was Schematic or Schematic from Jim, either one of those.
And I heard you say you might have sent it to blank by mistake. Well, run that by again. You might have sent it to where by mistake? I'll wait for all beeps in 1 or 2 seconds beyond that, Jim.
Yeah, I might have sent it twice, two times, by accident.
He said he may have sent it to Wesley, Dick.
I may have sent it twice. I may have sent it two times.
Okay, I'll take a look for it, Jim. And in the next couple of days, when I hear you on, and we'll compare notes when I see that. So I haven't seen it up till now, but I am a little bit behind it. I'm catching up with my email. Back to you, John, for the next one. KC2WGB after the wait. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. Okay. This comes from a young amateur who was interested in sideband. If he had a full-band AM broadcast transmitter with both upper and lower sidebands, he's interested to know that if he put a rectifier in the antenna, would he be transmitting sideband?
No. The way a transmitter works, the way a transmission line works, and the way an antenna works, those devices want to see a pure sine wave. And if you distort that sine wave in any way, like putting in a diode, putting any kind of a nonlinear device of any kind, you're now using the antenna in the transmission lines in a very different manner. You start making different waveforms.